Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, which is Wednesday, March 13th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Patty with our first story.
Thank you, Rachel. Flooding floodwaters. Storm sewer being updated to prevent flooding. There's a photograph here of a very, looks like large, long pipe. What it is, it's a temporary sewer line. They're going to bury it later. This is written for us by Sarah Watson. Motorists on East River Drive in Davenport might notice some construction. Underway is a $4 million COVID relief-funded storm sewer replacement project that aims to prevent floodwaters from surging up from underground because of backed-up storm sewer systems. It's one of a list of projects the city is working on of its $165 million flood mitigation plan, which was authored by H.R. Green and approved by the City Council in 2021. The construction on East River Drive involves installing new underground pipes and gate valves to prevent backflow from the Mississippi River into the storm sewer system on River Drive between 3rd Street and Tremont Avenue. Once complete, the updates will keep East River Drive near 3rd and 4th Street open until flood stage 22.5 feet, according to the city. Currently, it closes at about 17.5 feet. The record crest at the Rock Island Gauge is 22.7 feet, set during the 2019 flood. The construction work has narrowed the thoroughfare to two lanes and eliminated left turns onto East 4th Street and Federal Street and closed Mound Street entrance to the village of East Davenport. The city said this is to ensure traffic movement on River Drive considering the reduced lanes. Lane reductions are expected to last until late June or early July, depending on weather and underground conditions, according to the city. Work along the riverfront and recreational path will continue through mid to late March, according to the city. The riverfront recreational trail is closed between Government Bridge and Prospect Park until that time, because of heavy machinery work going on near the trail. Business and residents clamored for a more permanent solution to addressing surging floodwaters after the river crested at a record 22.7 feet in 2019, breaking temporary HESCO barriers and causing upwards of $30 million in lost revenue and damages. For decades, Davenport residents have resisted a flood wall for concerns it would impede residents' access to and views of the mighty Mississippi. Now, high costs and feasibility, too, make a flood wall impractical in the eyes of Davenport officials. The H.R. Green study proposes other measures as part of a three-phase plan that aims to keep River Drive open at a flood stage of 22 feet. That includes underground storm sewer infrastructure updates, raising sections of roadway, and starting a cost-share program between the city and business owners to flood-proof the buildings. Also ongoing is a construction on storm sewer improvements at the intersection of River Drive and Marquette Street to install future bypass storm sewer and backflow prevention to halt river water from backing up into the intersection of River Stage 14.5 feet. Instead, the project would keep the intersection unflooded until 18.5 feet, which will cut down on usage of temporary pumps the city used to try to keep that intersection open. For more updates, see davenportiowa.com/news/ What's New Davenport?
Also on the front page, some national news. Panel hears from her. This is from the AP by Zeke Miller, Colleen Long, and Farnoosh Amiri. Lawmakers turned a Tuesday hearing on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents into a proxy battle between the Democratic president and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, as a newly released transcript of Biden's testimony last fall showed he repeatedly insisted he never meant to retain classified information after he left the vice presidency. Special Counsel Robert Hur, testifying for more than 4 hours before the House Judiciary Committee, stood steadfastly by the assessments in his 345-page report that questioned Biden's age and mental competence but recommended no criminal charges for the 81-year-old president, finding insufficient evidence to make a case stand up in court. What I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe, Hur said. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. The transcript of hours of interviews between Biden and the special counsel released Tuesday provide a more textured picture of the roughly year-long investigation, filling in some of the gaps left by hers and Biden's accounting of the exchanges. While Biden was adamant that he treated classified information seriously, the transcript shows he was at times fuzzy about dates and details, and he said he was unfamiliar with the paper trail for some of the sensitive documents he handled. The hearing played out just hours before Biden claimed the Democratic nomination and Trump was on the cusp of becoming the GOP standard bearer. The party lines calcified almost immediately over which leader meant to hang on to classified documents, or rather who willfully retained them and who didn't. Hur was the rare witness vilified all around by Republicans angry over his decision not to charge the president and by Democrats for his unflattering commentary about Biden. Republicans argued Biden was given a pass by his own Justice Department and that Trump was unfairly victimized by prosecutors. Democrats, for their part, stressed Biden's cooperation in the investigation and strongly contrasted that with the separate criminal case against Trump, who refused to return classified documents requested by the National Archives that he had at his Florida estate. Biden's team returned the documents after they were discovered, and the president cooperated with the investigation by voluntarily sitting for an interview and consenting to searches of his homes. Trump, by contrast, is accused of enlisting the help of aides and lawyers to conceal the documents from the government and seeking to have potentially incriminating evidence destroyed. Hur, in his report, detailed how his findings about Biden were far different from those of Special Counsel Jack Smith about Trump, who has been charged with willfully retaining classified documents. FBI agents searched Trump's Florida estate in 2022 and removed boxes of documents marked as classified after he refused multiple requests from the National Archives to return them. Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, the ranking Democrat, asked whether Biden's willingness to comply with investigators and turn over documents contributed to the decision not to charge him. That was a factor in our analysis, Hur said. But the Democrats quickly bored into Hur, who was chosen by Biden's own attorney general, suggesting he was a political partisan doing Republican bidding via his written slights about Biden's age and memory. Hur took issue with the characterization. He responded, "Politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps, my decisions, and the words that I put in my report." Republicans, meanwhile, questioned how the two cases were really all that different. Representative Tom McClintock, Republican of California, called it a glaring double standard. Donald Trump's being prosecuted for exactly the same act that you documented Joe Biden committed, he told her. Her's report cited evidence that Biden willfully held on to highly classified information and shared it with a ghostwriter based on audio of the conversations between the two men, in which Biden said he had just come across some classified documents at his home. According to the transcript, Biden told her he did not recall the exchange or that he had actually discovered any documents. He said if he had discussed anything questionable with the ghostwriter, it was in referring to a 20-page sensitive memo he had written to then-President Barack Obama in 2009, arguing against surging troops in Afghanistan that he wanted to ensure didn't make it into publication. Hearst said he was aware of the need to explain in great detail why he decided not to charge the president and why the case didn't meet the standard for criminal charges. Such explanations are common but usually kept confidential. But there's a tradition at the Justice Department to release such documents publicly, and so as Herr was working on his report, he almost certainly would have understood that the document was going to see the light of day. Hearst said, "The need to show my work was especially strong here. The Attorney General had appointed me to investigate the actions of the Attorney General's boss, the sitting President of the United States. I knew that for my decision to be credible, I could not simply announce that I recommended no criminal charges and leave it at that. I needed to explain why." He added that, quote, "the evidence and the President himself put his memory squarely at issue."
Now for some local news. Brewery bandits steal kettle. Kettle stolen from Great River Brewery, written for us by Gretchen Teske. Bad news. A kettle was stolen from Great River Brewery. Good news. It was recovered and everything is still on track for the brewing company to return to downtown Davenport. Construction on Great River Brewery, 332 East 2nd Street, has been ongoing for months following the business's closure after the 2019 flood. But this weekend, it faced a minor setback. Davenport police officers responded Saturday morning to the brewery where the kettle's owner told them someone took it out of the parking lot where he stored it, according to court records. During that interview, the owner told police the kettle was worth between $14,000 and $20,000. The kettle was supposed to go into Great River, but had not made it inside the building yet. Saturday morning, crews discovered the theft and alerted police, brewery Scott Florence, brewery partner. Police got right to work and soon discovered the kettle caper was caught on camera. It had been recorded by security footage from the Lost Picture House across the street. Three men, Russell D. Figley, 60, Matthew D. Figley, 30, and James A. Crafton, 53, all of Davenport, are facing charges on allegations they were the ones that carried off the kettle, according to Scott County court documents. The Figleys have the same address, but the court records do not otherwise specify their relationship. Authorities have charged all three with first-degree theft and first-degree criminal mischief. Crafton also faces a charge of driving under suspension. Court records did not identify the kettle's owner. Security footage showed the suspects arriving in the parking lot just before 4 p.m. on Friday. One of them gets out of the vehicle, loads the kettle into a pickup truck, and is off the lot by 4:11 p.m. Authorities used largely the same narrative in the arrest affidavits for all three men. The charges against Crafton, however, specify him as the alleged driver of the Chevrolet Silverado used in the theft. He is suspended from driving in Iowa indefinitely. About 20 minutes later, the stolen kettle arrived at Midwest Recyclers on South Howell Street, according to court records. Midwest staff told investigators that the vehicle with the kettle arrived at the scrapyard close to 4:30 p.m. Before paying for the kettle, the staff cut it open to ensure it was empty, court records state. Repairing that damage is expected to cost about $10,000. Once police arrived at Midwest to investigate, staff were able to provide identifying information about the seller and also had security camera footage to share. Sunday, Davenport police contacted Florence at Great River to let him know the kettle had been found. It is now being patched up before making its way back to the brewery. Monday, police arrived at the Figley residence at about 8:45 a.m. There, officers found one of the vehicles they suspect was used in the theft and met at least one of the Figleys who, after being Mirandized, admitted to taking the kettle, records state. Davenport officers brought Russell Figley to the Scotch County Jail at about 9:20 a.m. on Monday, according to the jail website. They booked Matthew Figley about 20 minutes later. The affidavits for Crafton do not specify the circumstances of his arrest. He was booked into the Scott County Jail around 7 p.m. on Thursday. Russell and Matthew Figley remained in the Scott County Jail Tuesday, each held on a $10,000 bond, the jail website states. Both have their next court hearing scheduled for March 22nd. Those that frequented Great River prior to its closing in 2019 will have a whole new layout to look forward to. The brewing operations will be in the section of the building directly across the street from the Half Nelson. The larger space will allow for more tanks and more beer. In the back of the building is the space where Florence will set up his Streets of Italy project, serving pizza with an emphasis on pickup and takeout. A mezzanine level inside the building will add more seating and extend into an outdoor deck. The large garage doors outside the patio is where the bar will be set up, with room for more tables and chairs. Connor Wood, who wrote this, he contributed it. He is of the Quad City Times Dispatch.
Also on the local page, a couple of short articles about local happenings. Grand Parade to be held Saturday. This by Thomas Geyer. The St. Patrick's Society's Grand Parade number 38 will be held Saturday starting in Rock Island at 11:30 a.m. before crossing the Stanley Talbot Memorial Centennial Bridge into Davenport. This year's Grand Marshal is Terry O'Connell, who has lived in the Quad Cities since 1971. Originally from Wheaton, Illinois, where he attended St. Francis High School, O'Connell moved to the Quad Cities to attend St. Ambrose University. He and his wife, Linda, were married in May of 1976 at Lourdes Catholic Church in Bettendorf. O'Connell worked in the robotics and factory automation industry beginning in 1982 and is president of Pabau Automation Business Consulting. This year's Irish mother is Stephanie Taylor of Cambridge, Illinois. An Irish dancer in her youth, Taylor is a teaching assistant with the Champaign Academy of Irish Dance at Bishop Hill Creative Commons. She was nominated for Irish Mother of the Year by her husband, John. All three of her children do Irish dance. O'Connell and Taylor will be introduced at the Gathering of the Clan luncheon at the River Center on Friday. Luncheon reservations can be made by emailing vicquinn2016@gmail.com. The parade will start from the corner of 23rd Street and 4th Avenue in Rock Island, pass over the Centennial Bridge and proceed through downtown Davenport along 3rd Street to the Davenport River Center. The Iowa-bound lanes of the Centennial Bridge will be closed from 11 a.m. to about 1:30 p.m. on Saturday. And then also this from Kelowna, new businesses to open. Donut shop to open where car wash used to be. A number of businesses are planning to open in Kelowna with TIF agreements with the city. Mayor Don Rupp on Monday gave aldermen an update on a number of businesses planning to open or expand in the city. He said the Midwest Massage Therapy and Wellness Center in front of Stonebridge Subdivision is doing inside work like painting and has rocked the parking lot, planning to let it sit this year and pour concrete next season. They are real close to opening soon, he said. He said the donut shop called Glazed is in the process of being done in its new location where the car wash used to be. And TJMJ, which has proposed a 5,000 square foot building as an incubator business and storage units, is working on finalizing drawings. He said he had just signed a first reimbursement check for TJMJ's owner, Rock River Electric. He also said he would be talking soon with a woman who is interested in opening a Mexican restaurant grocery in TIF 5. An agenda item for waiving bidding requirements for several small public works jobs, staying under the $25,000 statutory limit per contract, was not voted on by the council. Alderperson Sarah Lack said she wanted to know more about whether it was five projects costing $5,000 each or 10 projects, for example. I want a better idea of what is happening, she added. In response, the mayor said he was withdrawing the item from the agenda.
Another local article here. Geneseo officer receives statewide award. Written for us by Lisa Hammer of, Detective Jamie Shoemaker of the Geneseo Police Department has been named Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board Executive Institute's 2024 Women in Criminal Justice Female Officer of the Year. Shoemaker was named to the honor for her exceptional dedication to serving the Geneseo community, in particular her work with mental health and crisis calls. The award will be presented at the 2024 Women in Criminal Justice Conference in April, where her outstanding contributions will be celebrated. Shoemaker was handpicked by an 8-member statewide committee. She stood out for her significant impact, especially in her advocacy for mental health and crisis awareness. We couldn't be prouder of Detective Shoemaker's unwavering commitment to raising mental health awareness on the front lines, Deputy Chief Gene Carson said, adding the entire Geneseo department has bought into the mental health initiative with Shoemaker leading the charge. Her compassion and dedication to the Geneseo community are truly inspiring, Chief Casey Disterhoff said. Shoemaker has a decade of experience in law enforcement, including 3 years in Geneseo. And I wanted to mention that we have the Vander Veer Conservatory is staging a flower show, the Spring Floral Show. Now, it doesn't say how long it will be going on, but it is currently going on. We're almost out of stuff to read, but here's the national article. A ship stocked with aid sets sail. The charity mission is separate from U.S. plans to build a floating dock. And Wafa Sharafa and Sammy Magdi and Menelaos Hajikostas wrote this. They work for the Associated Press. Rafa, Gaza Strip. An aid ship loaded with some 200 tons of food set sail for Gaza on Tuesday in a pilot program for the opening of a sea corridor to the territory where the five-month-old Israel-Hamas war has driven hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to the brink of starvation. The push to get food in by sea, along with a recent campaign of airdrops into isolated northern Gaza, highlighted the international community's frustration with a growing humanitarian crisis and its inability to get aid in by road. The food on the aid ship was collected by the World Central Kitchen charity and is being transported by the Spanish aid group Open Arms. The ship departed from Cyprus and is expected to arrive in Gaza in 2 or 3 days. The U.S. has separately announced plans to construct a floating dock near Gaza to deliver aid, but it will likely be weeks before it is operational. 4 U.S. Army boats with equipment and steel pier segments left Virginia on Tuesday, headed to Gaza. President Joe Biden's administration has provided military aid for Israel while urging it to facilitate more humanitarian access. The war, triggered by Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes. A quarter of Gaza's population is starving, according to the United Nations. The U.S., Qatar, and Egypt tried to broker a ceasefire and hostage release ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which began at sundown Sunday. The talks stalled as Hamas demanded any temporary pause in the fighting come with guarantees for ending the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to expand the offensive into the Strip's southern city of Rafah, where half of Gaza's population has sought refuge, and to keep fighting until Hamas is dismantled. Aid groups say it is nearly impossible to deliver aid in much of Gaza because of Israeli restrictions. Ongoing hostilities, trucks brought humanitarian aid directly into hard-hit northern Gaza on Tuesday evening, coordinated by the Israeli military, which called it a pilot program.
We have a couple of minutes before we turn to the obituaries. U.S. inflation up again as prices remain elevated. This from the Associated Press. Consumer prices in the United States picked up last month, a sign that inflation remains a persistent challenge for the Federal Reserve and for President Joe Biden's reelection campaign, both of which are counting on a steady easing of price pressures this year. Prices rose 0.4% from January to February, higher than the previous month's figure of 0.3%, the Labor Department said on Tuesday. Compared with a year earlier, consumer prices rose 3.2% last month, above January's 3.1% annual pace. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core prices also climbed 0.4% from January to February, matching the previous month's rise. Core inflation is watched closely because it typically provides a better read of where inflation is likely headed. In his State of the Union speech last week, Biden criticized many large companies for engaging in price gouging and shrinkflation, in which a company shrinks the amount of product rather than raising the price. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less, Biden said. It's time to turn to the obituaries in today's Quad City Times. There are several pending services, so I'll start with those. David Ridenour, age 74, of Minooka, Illinois, and Las Vegas, Nevada, formerly of Moline, died Thursday, March 7th. Shyla Manning, age 42, of Maquoketa, died on Sunday, March 10th. Larry Tubbs, age 77, of Maquoketa, passed away on Monday morning, March 11th. Lulu Bell Koch, age 87, of Maquoketa, passed away on Sunday morning, March 10th. Jesse Goswick, age 73, of Rock Island, died on Tuesday, March 12th. Kathleen, or Kathy, Wiersba, age 78, of Walcott, died on Saturday, March 9th. Robert, or Bob, M. Spain, age 77, formerly of Moline and Carbon Cliff, passed away Saturday, March 9th. Rosemary DeMay, age 94, of Geneseo, passed away on Monday, March 11th. William Bill Dines, age 69, of Mineral, Illinois, passed away unexpectedly on March 9th. And Todd Eric Grant, age 60, of Rock Island, passed away on Monday, March 11th. Those services are all pending. The first of our three obituaries is for Tanner David Brundage. Tanner David Brundage, age 25, of Bluegrass, Iowa, and formerly of Andrew, DeWitt, and Davenport, Iowa, passed away on March 9th, 2024. Tanner was a beloved and cherished son, brother, grandson, nephew, cousin, and friend, whose vibrant spirit and kind heart left a lasting impression on all who knew him. Tanner David Brundage was born on March 24, 1998, in Maquoketa, to Michael David and Nicole Marie Brundage Fisher. His early education took place in DeWitt, where he graduated from DeWitt Community High School in 2016. He went on to complete a rigorous five-year NECA IBEW Journeyman Apprenticeship Training Course to earn his Journeyman Electrician's Card, which he achieved in 2023 among the program's top graduates. Tanner's work ethic was evident from high school through his career as an electrician. He began detasseling corn at 14 years old and seemingly worked every day thereafter, whether it was serving snacks at the Clinton Lumber King's concession stand, or sandwiches at Hungry Hobo, or hanging drywall. After graduation, he honed his skills in the construction industry with Schuler & Sons Construction, Quality Construction Services, and Seifert Building Supplies. In 2018, Tanner proudly joined the IBEW Local Number 145, where he worked until the present. Through the IBEW, Tanner worked on electrical projects at notable commercial and industrial sites, such as the Quad City International Airport and the Rock Island Arsenal. Tanner's interests were diverse and fulfilling. He was an ardent and dedicated supporter of the Iowa Hawkeyes, holding season tickets for the home football games and traveling to the Hawkeyes bowl games. Tanner loved sports, having played baseball and basketball in his youth. He was also a skilled carpenter. Tanner's finished projects reliably showcased his meticulous and careful nature. His competitive spirit shone through as a member of the Bettendorf Merchants Bowling League, enjoying the camaraderie of his teammates and friends. Tanner's spirit, heart, and sense of humor always shone through during the time he enjoyed spending with friends and family. He was confirmed at and a member of Grace Lutheran Church in DeWitt. Those left to honor his memory include his parents, Nicole Fisher of Eldridge, Iowa, and Michael Fisher of Maquoketa, brothers Logan Bundridge of Des Moines and Caleb Fisher of Maquoketa, paternal grandparents, Ruth and Tim Grover of Miles, Iowa, and Francis and Vicki Fisher of Loudoun, Iowa, and several aunts, uncles, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his maternal grandparents, Harold and Garnett Brundage, as well as maternal aunts and uncles. A celebration of Tanner's life will be held at 12 p.m. Tuesday, March 14th, at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Visitation will be held prior to the service from 10 a.m. to noon at the funeral home. Cremation rites have been accorded. In lieu of other expressions of sympathy, a Tanner D. Brundage Memorial Fund has been established, and online condolences may be left at carsonandson.com.
Davenport, Estella E. Carlson, July 21st, 1926 to March 9. Estella E. Carlson, 97, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, March 9th, at her home. Funeral services will be 2:30 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Davenport, with visitation from 1 p.m. to service time at the church. Her live stream service can be viewed on Rafferty Funeral Home's Facebook page. Graveside service will be Monday, March 18th, at 1 p.m. at Greenwood Cemetery in Mobridge, South Dakota, with Pastor Justin Van Orman. Memorials can be made to the church. Estella was born July 21st, 1926, in Bowdell, South Dakota, the daughter of Reinhardt and Lydia Blumhardt Bayer. She married Martin A. Carlson on June 11, 1944, in Mobridge, South Dakota. He preceded her in death January 7, 1993. Estella was a member of St. Paul Lutheran Church. Estella enjoyed crafting and loved her family and attending their activities and events. Survivors include her children, Sandy, Scott, Sharon Yund of Davenport, and Deb Cohute of Coal Valley. Grandchildren, 13 of them, and 24 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, sister Ike, and brothers Mahon and Dwayne. Condolences may be left at RaffertyFunerals.com. And lastly, we have Helen Joyce White, January 1, 1961 to March 7th. Memorial services for Helen Joyce White, 63, of Davenport, will be 12 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th, at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Family will greet friends on Saturday from 11 a.m. to service time at the funeral home. Helen passed away on Thursday, March 7th, at Genesis Medical Center at in Davenport. She was surrounded by her loved ones at the time of her passing. Helen Joyce Norment was born on January 1st, 1961 in Chicago, the daughter of Emerson and Geneva Turner Norment. She worked as a nurse and caregiver for several Quad City nursing homes for 20 years, retiring in 2004. Helen enjoyed spending time with and cooking for family and friends. Survivors include her children Dominique, Brittany Austin, Joseph Austin, Paul Austin, Leroy Liatta, Ellen Galvin Normant, Brian Normant, and Michael and Erskine, and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Helen was preceded in death by her parents, daughter Tanya Austin, siblings Vincent, Ronald, Colette, Renee, and Kevin. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be shared with the family at McGinnisChambers.com.
That completes the obituaries from today's Quad City Times. Now we'll turn to the opinion page. The first opinion is Biden's State of the Union viewed from Russia. This is written by Rachel Marsden, a columnist and political strategist. Her columns are syndicated by Tribune Content Agency. This dateline is Moscow. Unlike most folks here in Russia who follow domestic American politics about as much as Americans care about the price of parking in Moscow, I subjected myself to U.S. President Joe Biden's assessment of the current state of America, which apparently also now includes Ukraine, Europe, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Biden said Putin of Russia is on the march, invading Ukraine and sowing chaos throughout Europe and beyond. Just a few sentences earlier, Biden said that Hitler was on the march, war was raging in Europe. Well, that's subtle. Might want to just leave Hitler chilling on the bench of history right now, guys, if only because as part of the U.S.-backed scheme to train Ukrainians to take on Russians, Canada was already on record as voicing concerns in 2018 about Azov battalion trainees sporting Nazi symbols, as the Ottawa Citizen reported in 2021. Then the U.S. allies drew attention to a similar inconvenient reality when Canada's parliament honored and cheered a bona fide World War II Nazi from Ukraine's Galicia division of Hitler's Waffen-SS last fall, in the fist-pumping presence of Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, all because he killed Russians back in the day. We're talking about the same Soviet Red Army Russians who just happened to be our allies against Hitler. But that history has now been erased to the extent that an overtly anti-fascist Russian president who has literally cited denazification of the West-trained neo-Nazi fighters in Ukraine as one of his two prime operational objectives in Ukraine is now being likened to Hitler by the current Oval Office occupant. The guy who wants to ban TikTok inside the U.S. said that freedom and democracy are under attack overseas. Biden also said that if anybody in this room thinks Putin will stop at Ukraine, I assure you he will not. Shortly thereafter, Biden said of the NATO military alliance that has expanded right up to Russia's border since the end of the Cold War that we've made NATO stronger than ever, calling it the strongest military alliance the world has ever seen. But apparently, Biden figures that it's not so strong that Putin won't hesitate to just walk right onto its turf and punch it square in the face. Excuse me. As Biden himself might say, pick a lane, man. Putin's still in Russia's own backyard, actually. Unlike Biden, who's long treated Ukraine like an outpost of the State Department on the other side of the planet. Excuse me. As vice president in 2015, Biden cheered U.S.-backed regime change in Ukraine. You forced out a corrupt leader to win another chance at democracy, is how he framed the coup. Ukraine is fighting for its future on the battlefields of the East, Biden said, nearly a decade ago, of helping Ukraine to gin up conflict with Russia on its own border, and already justifying security assistance. And Putin isn't really the one making chaos in Europe either. Rather, Europe is making chaos for itself in an effort to constantly one-up itself with its own pro-Ukrainian, anti-Russian virtue signaling. It cut itself off from Russian pipeline gas, but then increased imports of Russian liquefied natural gas by 40% over pre-war levels, as a Global Witness report found last year. More recently, Brussels has been paying lip service to Kyiv's demands to cut itself off totally from the remaining 15% of Russian pipeline gas that it's still importing, all while neglecting to explain exactly how Ukraine, which the EU has committed to financially supporting at its taxpayers' expense, will power itself, particularly at the same cost, when Ukraine's own gas supply comes from Russian gas transited across its territory and then reverse flowed back from Europe. Also, just last week, the EU's Trade Committee voted to extend free trade for Ukrainian farm products being dumped into the EU to the detriment of the bloc's own farmers. Yet it was Putin himself who gave the heads up as far back as 2022 that the Ukrainian produce that Brussels promised to deliver to the world's poor, if Putin would only let it out of the Black Sea region, was actually just ending up being dumped inside the bloc itself. Almost all the grain exported from Ukraine is sent not to the poorest developing countries, but to EU countries, Putin said in September of 2022. It's a statement which, although now proven true, was dismissed by Kyiv. The Russians' fakes about sending Ukrainian grain only to Europe simply do not correspond to reality. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, said, "Guess all those tractors blocking highways across Europe are fakes, too." Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that it needs to defend itself, Biden said, clearly referencing the Republicans' refusal of more financing for Americans' weapons manufacturers so they can crank out more stuff for the Russians to blow up. U.S. officials assured a year ago that Kyiv had everything it needed for the counteroffensive. But as they say, 25th time's the charm, right? Biden said, "I say this to Congress. We have to stand up to Putin. Send me a bipartisan national security bill. History is literally watching." Sounds like a telethon for the American outfits making the weapons that Ukrainians will carry onto the battlefield, at least until they run out of Ukrainians. Forget about what Russians might think and be more concerned with the fact that this kind of tone-deaf propaganda isn't going to win over any Americans or Westerners still even remotely capable of independent critical thought. Again, that by Rachel Marsden, a columnist and political strategist, and who is syndicated by the Tribune Content Agency.
You are paying for every newcomer who comes here illegally. Written for us by John Donald O'Shea, who is a retired circuit judge. During the Trump years, the Democrats declared the cities that they ran to be sanctuary cities and refused to cooperate with federal authorities to remove newcomers illegally here, even when they had committed serious crimes. Now they are confronted with the costs of an open border, and now the mayors of New York and Chicago and the other large Democratic cities are demanding that the feds pick up the tab. In New York, luxury hotels are being repurposed at taxpayers' expense to house the newcomers who have flooded across our southern border and ended up in New York. Does that make sense? When my mother immigrated to the United States nearly a century ago, immigrants who were unable to take care of themselves without becoming public charges were declared unsuitable for American citizenship and therefore denied entry. Today, family members who ask that their relative be afforded green card status are asked to sponsor them to keep them from becoming public charges. Do those rules make more sense? Imagine that upon waking up in the morning, you hear water running. Because the sound seems to be coming from the basement, you check. As you start down the basement steps, your worst fears are quickly confirmed. The 1-inch water pipe in the exposed rafters, some 8 feet above the meter, has burst and is pouring 20 gallons of water per minute into your basement. What do you do? A, climb in back into bed and hope the problem goes away. B, grab a bunch of old rags and begin sopping up the water. C, begin moving the basement furniture outside to dry. D, close the main shutoff valve. Any sane individual would choose to close the main shutoff valve, but not President Biden. Consider the crisis at our southern border and compare. President's first step was to close the main shutoff valve. build a state-of-the-art border wall to keep newcomers from illegally entering the United States between our ports of entry. President Joe Biden's first step upon taking office was to immediately halt construction to close the remaining gaps in the wall. He believes that if he welcomes the newcomers with open arms, provides them with free food, housing, schooling for their children, medical care, cell phones, etc., that the newcomers will be forever grateful to him and his fellow Democrats and will vote Democrat for the rest of their lives, thereby guaranteeing that the Democrats win all future elections. And what is the cost to the taxpayer of the Biden vote-buying scheme? The Federation for American Immigration Reform, after taking account of the taxes that the newcomers pay into the federal treasury, estimates the cost to be $150 billion annually. You could easily calculate your share of that, as well as the shares of your spouse and each of your children. Again, he's from John Donald O'Shea is from Moline. He's a regular columnist.
We turn to sports, and because the Big Ten Freshman of the Year is a local to Quad City Times readers, I'm going to read that story to be sure we get it in before we have to close. Freeman named Big Ten Freshman of the Year by Dave Selvig. Owen Freeman has not been surprised by his freshman season success in the Big Ten. If anything, the 2023 Moline High School grad said he should have done more. Considering how he's played, that's a high bar. Freeman was named the Big Ten's Freshman of the Year on Tuesday, following a season in which the 6'10 standout is averaging 10.6 points, 6.5 rebounds, and 1.8 blocks per game. "Not really surprising, no. I worked pretty hard for what I did," said Freeman, who repeatedly credited his faith for his success. "If anything, there's more I could have shown. I'll continue to be in the gym working hard and show that next year." Freeman won the media's freshman award solo. He shared the coach's honor with Indiana's Mackenzie Ngakpo at 12.2 points per game and 4 rebounds. Freeman earned the weekly Big Ten Freshman Award 9 times, 7 more than Mbako. That Freeman ended up sharing the coach's award seemed to catch everyone off guard. "I was a little surprised," Freeman admitted. "Mackenzie's a great player. I got nothing but respect for him." Freeman is just the second Hawkeye to win the award, joining Jess Settles in 1994. He was also named honorable mention All-Big Ten, one of 5 Hawkeyes honored. Senior Tony Perkins was named to the second team. Junior Peyton Sanford was named to the third team. Sophomore Josh Dix and senior Ben Crick joined Freeman, earning honorable mention recognition. Freeman began the season coming off the bench for the Hawkeyes, but has started the last 23 games. He's shooting a team-best 63.6% from the floor. He also has 36 assists and 30 steals, none of which has surprised his coach. "We recruited him as an impact player," Fran McCaffrey said. "When he committed, we were really excited and felt very comfortable at that time that he was going to be immediately impactful. He had a great summer, a great trip overseas. No, I'm not surprised." McCaffrey said Freeman's success goes beyond his physical gifts. "He always had a skill set that we felt would translate well to his level with his size," McCaffrey said. "He's got a great demeanor, great work ethic. He's a very mature young guy. There's more to come. He can shoot the ball, and I think that's the next step for him," McCaffrey said. "Facing up from 17 feet, picking and popping, shooting threes, will help him develop his shooting, and that will definitely help with his pro career down the road." Most of Freeman's points have come in the paint this season, but he's looking to expand his game. Just becoming more confident in my jump shot, he said. I've shown it in practice, just have to be more comfortable with it in the game. Freeman and the Hawkeyes, which are 18-13, are zeroed in on the Big Ten tournament at Target Center in Minneapolis for their first-round opponent, Ohio State, on Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Many believe it's a must-win game for both teams' NCAA tournament hopes. Freeman said, "Our leaders have done a great job just making sure we focus on one practice at a time, one game at a time, and don't look too far ahead," Freeman said. "I'm looking forward to going out and competing and making a run with my guys." What to watch on TV, the Hawkeyes, as we just read, Thursday at 5:30, meet Ohio State at the Big Ten tournament. Illinois versus OSU or Iowa on Friday. The Iowa State Cyclones versus Texas or K-State on Thursday at 6. So those are some of the games that are coming up. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.